Good afternoon, and thanks for coming to this Founders Day lecture. My name is Daniel Usner. I'm chair of the Department of History, but I've only been at Vanderbilt for 4 years. This is my fourth year. Now, if I were 30 years younger, that means I'd be a senior, ready to graduate and leave. But I'm having too much fun embracing and enjoying the rich traditions here at Vanderbilt, and that includes the Founders Day ceremonies. And there's no better way, I won't say easier way, to learn about an institution like Vanderbilt than to agree to serve as chair of a department. So I'm learning quickly, and there are some predictable things that you get to do as chair, and then once in a while something unpredictable occurs that turns out to be a great pleasure. As some of you know, the chancellor of Vanderbilt University usually hosts this event, but unfortunately for us, not for him, Gordon Gee is out of the country. I'm not in any way going to try to replace the irreplaceable Chancellor Gee, so I'm going to play this straight and somewhat laconic and simply say that it's a great pleasure and honor to introduce the 2006 Founders Day lecturer. Michael E. McGurr is the Paul V. McNutt Professor of American History at Indiana University. McGurr earned his PhD at Yale University in 1984. He also had received his bachelor's and master's degrees at Yale in history there. He has been a member of the Indiana University faculty since 1989. Professor McGurr's scholarship includes important articles in such journals as Civil War History, the Journal of American History, and the American Historical Review. These and other essays exhibit tremendous range in topics and approaches. Perhaps the unifying commitment underneath these essays, however, is to expand how we historians examine political behavior and public action. He is not afraid to take on certain trends in historiography, as demonstrated in essays like The Price of the New Transnational History, published in 1991, and Is There a 20th Century West, published in 1993. Michael McGurr is the author of two highly regarded books on the late 19th and early 20th century United States: The Decline of Popular Politics, The American North, 1865 to 1928, was published by Oxford University Press in 1986, and A Fierce Discontent, The Rise and Fall of the Progressive Movement in America, 1870 to 1920, was published by the Free Press in 2003. Both of these studies make bold contributions to our understanding of how ideology and identity have shaped reform in American society. Furthermore, McGurr invites his readers to consider how the aspirations and limitations of one generation can profoundly influence future generations' politics and policies. Professor McGurr is also an accomplished and admired teacher who has garnered several awards offered by students and colleagues alike, including selection as Best Professor in the Bloomington Voice Readers Poll in 1994. And over dinner, I'm going to ask him how he accomplished that. His generous service to the profession includes committee work for national organizations, consultation for many documentary films, and participation on NEH fellowship panels. McGurr's leadership at Indiana University includes a stint as Arts and Sciences Associate Dean for Graduate Education and Program Development from 2000 to 2004. Somehow, he found time in the midst of all of that to co-author a widely used textbook, Making a Nation, A History of the United States, and he is currently working on its second edition. But Michael McGurr is with us this afternoon to share current work on the Vanderbilt family, which will appear as a book with the title, The the public be damned, the Vanderbilts and the unmaking of the ruling class. Benefiting from Cornelius Vanderbilt's gift back in 1873, we might feel less damned than others, but we are certainly grateful to Professor McGurr's presence here today. His lecture is entitled "The Commodore's Strange Gift, The Founding of Vanderbilt." So please join me in welcoming Professor Michael McGurr.
Thanks very much. Can you hear me in the back? You're all over on one side of the room close to the exit, so you don't feel damned now, but you're thinking about it. You know, I got that best professor reader's poll thing. I did nothing to get that, and it's an albatross around my neck because there is not an audience that I've stood in front of that hasn't heard that. So, oh, okay. All right, let's see. Especially professional audiences go, we'll judge that. So, no, I didn't do anything, and I think I would have given it back to some hapless professor of something else. It is really a pleasure for me to be here at Vanderbilt to talk about a family and an individual in particular of whom I've spent a good deal of time in the last few years and come to know in a different way. I have to tell you, when I was first invited to do this, I had a certain amount of trepidation because I had fear about talking about Cornelius Vanderbilt in a straightforward way that historians are supposed to do on an occasion that was supposed to celebrate his birthday and his benefaction to the university. So it's with substantial relief, I have to say, that by working hard in the archives since then, I've come to the conclusion that actually the Commodore was an extraordinary man, and increasingly I find myself something of an apologist for him. Other audiences may tax me about that. You may not, but we have time for questions at the end, and I'm willing to be taxed. I do want to say that the founding of this institution really is an extraordinary story, and I want to keep that to the forefront. It's a story that has got sex in it, fortunately, given the modern world in which we work. It has lots of sanctity. There's more religion in here than you could run for president in our politics on the amount of religion that's in this story. There are also spirits, there are ghosts in this. I swear to you, they play a critical part in explaining how Vanderbilt was founded. All of these things come together in the person of a man who was one of the least unlikely benefactors in the history of higher education. No one would have expected Cornelius Vanderbilt to do this thing, and he did it in the most roundabout way for reasons that seemed to have so much to do with luck, and yet this was a man who did virtually everything by intention. And part of what I want to do with you is to explore why a man who didn't believe in giving, who was deeply skeptical of charity, who had only gone to grade school, would end up doing something like this. So we want to think about what leads human beings to do the things they do, especially the generous things that they do. And this was a generous thing. And at the same time, too, we want, in a certain way, to think about this from the perspective of the people who were benefited from all of us, to think about the value of education, because in a peculiar way, this act was the most useful thing that Vanderbilt ever did, not only, obviously, for this institution and for the many men and women who studied here, but really, in the end, it served Vanderbilt's own purposes better than anything else he did. The railroads he founded, the houses he built, the many businesses he created. So I want to do those two things. And I will do them expeditiously enough that there's time for questions at the end if you want to do that. And if there's nothing, we can talk about the salacious story of that best professor thing. Cornelius Vanderbilt was a very hard man. People admired him over time. They respected him a great deal. They knew on some level he was a genius, but he was a very difficult human being. Difficult because he was perhaps one of the single most focused people that anyone had ever encountered. He was born in the right place at the right time. He was a very lucky man. He was born in 1794 on Staten Island, across from what would become the leading city of the United States, which would become the leading edge of the Industrial Revolution. He got himself a boat, a little Perry Auger, a bottomless, simple craft, when he was a teenager and went off to sea just at the point when steamships were coming into play. And so he found himself at the cutting edge of the steam revolution, made himself a really remarkable fortune, especially considering that he had come from virtually nothing. By the 1840s, in middle age, I often contemplate this, he was probably worth about $30 million when $30 million meant something. It still means something to a lot of us, I can imagine. And was quite proud of himself, built the largest steam yacht in the world, sailed off to Europe, puzzled people there, puzzled nobility, because here was this private citizen who had a ship that was bigger than anything they had. Came back and decided, and it's typical of him, that that wasn't enough. Cast about for something else to do, got into railroads just as they were emerging as the newest leading edge of transportation in this transportation revolution that would make industrial capitalism in the United States. And he became fabulously wealthy doing that, outstripping what he had done before. He concentrated his efforts in forming the New York Central Railroad, running up from New York City up to Albany and then west across New York State, out to Buffalo, and ultimately expanding that beyond to Chicago, building a railroad empire. He was typically called the Railway King, the Railroad King. It was in part because he had built this industrial kingdom, partly because of his own manner, his own habit of carrying himself. People always cast about for parallels to him. They would say he's like the Duke of Wellington, but I would say he's like a bishop. But in the end, over and over, they would compare him to a king because control was natural to him, reign was natural to him. He understood in this intuitive way what railroads were all about. At a time, they were the most sophisticated private business organizations in the world. Built up the New York Central, built up a bunch of other railroads until by the late 1860s, he was probably worth about $50, $60 million. And was widely conceded to be one of the three richest men in America, along with William Astor, New York City, owner of real estate, and A.T. Stewart, the dry goods king, as he was known, a man who ran a department store in New York. But Vanderbilt, in fact, was richer than they were, and when he died in 1877, he was probably worth about $95 million, which, considering that it was in the midst of what was then probably the worst depression in American history, was an extraordinary sum. It made him clearly the richest man in the United States and probably in the world. As I say, though, he was a very hard man, unusually focused. He loved conflict. He relished economic combat in a way that was scary even to his associates. He was not really a risk taker. He was one of those leaders who really understood that you let 99 things go in order to do the 100th and to do it absolutely. He scared people. People close to him in particular, he had a kind of brutal logic, a brutal familial logic, again, that was scary to people. He had three sons, one of whom he loved deeply, George Washington Vanderbilt, whom he thought was a really talented man. He died in the Civil War. He had a son, Cornelius Jeremiah Vanderbilt, who was an epileptic and probably homosexual. I think for that reason in particular, Cornelius Vanderbilt loathed his son. He effectively disinherited him. He drove him out of his house. He institutionalized him twice. His third son, William Henry Vanderbilt, I thought was, as he said, a blockhead, and stuck him on a farm in Staten Island until he was about 50. Again, encouraging all of us that maybe there's a future after 50. Those were his sons. His daughters were virtually useless to him. He had eight of them who survived to adulthood. Once he was sitting with a family friend and a bunch of his grandchildren were there, the children of his daughters, and the friend said to him, "Those are really lovely children, Commodore." And he said, "Well, they're not Vanderbilts." Vanderbilt was obsessed with his own name, and in strange ways that I don't fully understand, including he married his first cousin, Sophia Johnson, his first wife, who was his first cousin not once but twice. They had two common paths back to the same grandfather, which is an unusual thing and basic to this story, as you'll see. He was tough with her too. She bore him 13 children. When he decided that he no longer wanted to live on Staten Island, that he needed to be in New York City, he needed to be in Manhattan to oversee his business interests, she didn't want to go. He knew what to do. He stuck her in an asylum. And he did not take her out until she relented and they moved to New York. He is a very hard man. This story really begins, it's about the transformation of a really hard man to a limit, to a degree, and not an easy one either, because Vanderbilt, needless to say, did not like giving money away. He thought most charity was wasted. Like most people in his time, he believed that the charity corrupted people, that it robbed them of the work instinct, it robbed them of drive, it ultimately would be worse for them than having to go out and work and possibly be poor. He didn't like charity either because he thought most of the people who ran charities were fools. He was particularly low on ministers of the gospel. He brought a chaplain along on this famous trip to Europe and clearly wanted to throw him overboard after about day four. Too much prayer. And he also didn't particularly care for academics either. But he adjusted. And the adjustment really begins in August 1868, 5 years before the founding of this university. In August, he did what he often did. He went for a chunk of the summer to the resort Saratoga in the West End of New York, a place where there's a lot of horse racing and he loved horses. His wife, Sophia, didn't go to Saratoga with him. She went to the opposite end of New York State to take the waters on the Massachusetts border. There were waters in Saratoga, too, but these people had been married for 55 years, and they needed separate waters. She felt ill and went back to New York and had a stroke. He went racing back to New York City in his own private train, going at the unheard of speed of about 61, 62 miles an hour. People wondered what was going on through the state as he came back. At the time, his wife was there at their home. He thought that she was going to recover. They had some relations visiting from the South, a woman named Martha Crawford, a widow, and her daughter, Frank Crawford. Everything seemed to be fine, and then Sophia Vanderbilt had a second apoplectic stroke and died August 17, 1868. And it's at that point that the founding of this university really begins. Vanderbilt, rather suddenly, was a ruthless man. He was the richest man in the world. He was well over 70. He was getting old. He obviously, in many ways, did not have a strong relationship with his wife, but it was a very old one. And they were used to each other. And she had provided a kind of structure in his life. He didn't have that. He didn't have children that he particularly wanted to be with, as you can see. He had his work, but most of his own contemporaries were dying off. Even the wealthy didn't typically live well into their 70s at this point, wealthy men. What Vanderbilt had, even as he kept working hard, he found himself caught up in the past. Like a lot of Americans, including quite well-educated Americans, he believed in the spirit world. He believed that you could communicate with the dead. This was a great age of spirit wrappings, of consulting Ouija boards, and the like. As I say, in many ways, this was a very respectable thing. Vanderbilt yearned to communicate. He wanted to talk with his son, George, who had died, as I said, in the Civil War. He loved his mother. There's no surprise. You would have discerned that by now. He wanted very much to communicate with his mother, and he wanted to talk to Sophia, too, about the children and what to do with them, especially what to do with that epileptic namesake of his, Cornelius. Interesting choice of things to be interested in, because in a society that didn't accord women much in the way of rights or opportunity, the world of spiritualism, the world of spirit wrappings, of seances, of magnetic rubbing, as it was called, in which you pass your hands over the body of someone else, and through the power, the magnetic, the electrical power that the medium could convey, you could heal that individual, make them feel better. That was a woman's world. The world of the spirits was a woman's world. Most people, you know, at this time didn't die in hospitals. They died at home, in the domestic sphere, in woman's place. There were male spiritualists, but there were many women as well. It's a good thing, because Vanderbilt didn't find most male spiritualists very interesting. In fact, once he said, you know, there's no way this man can be for real. My mother would never spend time with a man as messy as that. Absolutely. But as I say, as it happened, there were women spiritualists as well. In October 1868, so just a couple months after the death of Sophia, at Vanderbilt's door, two women showed up. This is a common thing. People knew that Vanderbilt, difficult as he was willing to talk to people. She could come and see him, in a rather striking parade of people would come to his office or his house. So it was not surprising. These two women, sisters, turned up, Victoria Woodhull and Tennessee Claflin, who were about to become really the two most famous and notorious women in the United States. They were spiritualists. They were magnetic rubbers. Victoria was famous for her skill as a magnetic rubber. She also did seances. Tennessee Claflin, who was 22, Victoria was 29. Tennessee Claflin specialized in visions and predictions. She was very good at locating lost objects, supposedly. They had a checkered career. Their father's name was Buck Claflin. He was a confidence man, a horse thief, and he sold in Illinois and much of the Midwest a pioneering cancer cure. Their mother, Roxanna Claflin, was a medium who taught her daughters well, including how to have visions. Tennessee and Victoria had visions and were caught up in the spirit world in part because their father was such a nasty human being. Who beat them and mistreated them and used them to make money. When Tennessee Claflin turned up in New York City, she was a wanted woman. She was being sought on a charge of third-degree manslaughter back in Illinois because she had used her father's cancer cure on a woman who had breast cancer and burned her to death. These were curious people. They were advocates of free love. Victoria Woodhull had married once a man named Canning Woodhull, divorced him, and then married a man named Colonel James Blood, who was also an advocate of free love. They both believed that marriage was a prison, and so in 1866 they had divorced and continued to live together. They also lived with Canning Woodhull, which accounted a certain amount of comment. Both sisters had been arrested repeatedly for prostitution. They were also feminists. Victoria Woodhull especially believed in women's rights, the right to own property, the right to serve on juries, the right to vote. They were captivating people. They were very attractive, too. A newspaper writer once described Tennessee Claflin as having a magnificent shirt front that irritates men strangely. I try to keep this a family lecture. You filled that in for yourselves, as it were. These are the women who turned up at Vanderbilt's door. And this man strikes up a relationship with them. Victoria Woodhull becomes his magnetic physician. Tennessee Claflin has an undetermined relationship with him. According to her, she becomes his housekeeper. She works on his diet. She manipulates his prostate for him. And supposedly talks about marriage with her. Now, this is a rather unusual thing, to say the least. Vanderbilt's children, in particular, his daughters, are scandalized by all of this. Meanwhile, though, and I planted them there on purpose, they're the Crawfords, Martha and Frank Crawford. He's been seeing them, too. And many people believe that he's going to marry Martha Crawford, who's about 50, so 25 years younger than he is, pious Methodist, the families thinking, well, this would be better than the Free Love Advocates. August 21st, 1869, so almost a year and a day after the death of his wife, Bemidas newspaper reporters in London, Ontario, find out that the Commodore is at the Tecumseh Hotel, and in fact getting married. Not to Tennessee Claflin, not to Martha Crawford, but to Frank Crawford, who is 30, who's 45 years younger than the Commodore. Not only that, she's divorced. In a society that in which divorce very seldom ever happened, legal divorce was very rare among working class people, in part because they couldn't afford it. Among middle class people, it was scandalous, and among the wealthy, it was uncommon. Divorce was a dangerous proposition, especially for women. It meant really that your reputation was permanently altered. Even if you had been beaten and mistreated, nonetheless, society believed that in some way you had to have contributed to that outcome. So here is Cornelius Vanderbilt, richest man on the planet, marrying a woman 45 years younger than he is, who's divorced. You would think it would be an enormous scandal, and it was not, which tells you something about Frank Crawford, who was really an unusual person. In a way, if you were going to give a talk about the founding of Vanderbilt and really wanted to turn it on its end, you would give a talk about her rather than her husband, because Vanderbilt would not have happened without her. It's very unusual. Frank Armstrong Crawford was not named Francis. She had a man's name, because her father had been so bowled over by his own business partner, who was named Frank Armstrong, that he said when his wife was pregnant, I will name my child after you no matter what. Whether it was a girl or not, it was a girl. Frank Armstrong Crawford. So here's this rather tall, enigmatic woman, divorced. It's understood that the divorce happened because of the interference of her own family in some way, but it's kept very murky. No one criticizes her. It's the strangest thing, and it's not just kind of Victorian sensibility at work. Frank Armstrong, you can begin to understand why Vanderbilt married as he did. Many people say, well, why didn't you marry the mother? And he would just sort of sit there and you think, don't you all get it? It wasn't simply that she was younger. Frank Armstrong Crawford Vanderbilt was a lot of things that Vanderbilt was not. She was deeply religious. And it's that more than anything else that seems to have reconciled people to her past. No one questioned her piety. She was well known for doing good works in the Southern Methodist Church. She'd been part of a new church forming in New York City, the Church of the Strangers, an interdenominational church. She had such an aura of dignity and such an aura of piety and of sanctity that no one said, you're a fortune hunter, certainly not in public. She signed a prenuptial agreement with her husband that limited her rights to his estate to $500,000 in the house. Again, you think $500,000, but this is a man worth $95 million, excuse me, in the law of New York State. If he had died intestate, she would have inherited half of his fortune, which was a sense of what the norms at the time were. No one questioned her. The interesting thing is what was going on in Cornelius Vanderbilt's mind. We can laugh, but he could have found plenty of younger women who would have been willing to marry him and provided for various needs of his. But he chose to marry this woman who was deeply, devotedly engaged in the practice of organized religion. And he was not. And yet he did it on purpose and did it for a reason. Curious. She starts working on him right away. She sees his soul as her project. And to a degree, he thinks so too. He believes in God. He believes in the authenticity of the Bible, thanks to Mom, again. But he's not big on going to church. She's going to this place, the Church of the Strangers. And it's in temporary quarters at NYU in Washington Square, near where the Vanderbilts live. It's up a few flights of stairs. And she keeps telling him, you know, I'm tired of going upstairs. They're really very wearing on me. He's not dumb. He gets it. And he's absorbing this when our friends Victoria Woodhull and Tennessee Claflin turn up again. And there's a reason everybody's in this talk. They become, in February 1870, the first, quote, women stockbrokers in the United States. with great fanfare, a lot of newspaper publicity. They go into business on Wall Street selling stocks. There are such headlines as the bewitching brokers. There is an almost pornographic fantasizing over this union of money and pulchritude that New York newspapers almost can't bear. They also were billed repeatedly as Vanderbilt's proteges. And they speak very coyly about just what his relationship to them really is. Tennessee Claflin tells a reporter for the New York Herald, in fact, that she thought Vanderbilt had been intending to marry her. All very interesting and exciting if you're buying newspapers. For Frank Vanderbilt, you have to wonder what it meant for her. She was a person, though, of extraordinary reserve and dignity. She does not seem to have said to her husband, just exactly what did you do with Tennessee Claflin? What are you doing with them? No. They became ever more notorious. In May 1870, they began publishing Woodhull and Claflin's Weekly, a newspaper which became the launching pad for Victoria Woodhull's pioneering candidacy for president of the United States. Again, lots of publicity. Frank Vanderbilt plays her cards very carefully. She reminds Vanderbilt again that those stairs take some getting up at the Church of the Strangers. Finally, she arranges for him to meet her minister, a man I can't believe, love the name, Charles Force Deems, who is a good bit shorter than Vanderbilt, but is a lot like him. Very powerful man. I mean, the middle name is perfect. He has a muscular view of Christianity. He says life is a warfare. The struggle of the soul is war. Things that Vanderbilt himself think about the secular world. Both of them had lost a son in the Civil War. Both of them were Dutch in background. Vanderbilt begins to admire this man and decides in a wonderful moment, I love this, that he considers Deems' religion orthodox enough. Compared to what in Vanderbilt's life? I mean, in a nation that thought of him as basically soulless, the idea of him passing on Deems' appropriateness religiously is laughable, but there it is. Finally, Vanderbilt says to Deems, goes to church, and says to Deems, would you come over? I'm going to talk to you. And Deems says, I'm sorry, I can't make it. I've got to see it. I've got to do something else. And Vanderbilt, who's not, people jump for this man, says, what are you doing? And Dean says, well, I'm counseling a young couple on marriage. And Vanderbilt says, what about the next night? No. Night after that? No. Night after that? Dean says, no. Vanderbilt is intrigued. He's captivated now. Nobody says no to him. Deems either is an enormous fool or quite something. They get over there. Deems knows better than to ask for the money to buy a church, which is what he really needs, a permanent building. And this is a setup. But of course, Vanderbilt knows it's a setup, too. He says to Deems, you know, I'll give you a church. And instead of having Deems melt in front of him, Deems gets furious at him and says, what do you think I am, a kept man, some kind of chaplain? It's a great moment because, of course, Vanderbilt had to catch a chaplain back on that trip, the guy he wanted to cross over. He goes, no, I want you to, you know, again, he's thinking, what, you know, in the world I work in, you give money, they take it. In fact, they steal it from you. Look, what is it with this man that I want to give him this blasted church, and he won't take it? So they have this comic scene in which finally Dean says, oh, all right, I'll take it. And Vanderbilt goes, all right, Frank is happy, Deems is happy, and Vanderbilt is actually feels rather good about it, in spite of himself. Deems is in this talk for a purpose, too. So Vanderbilt has gone into the newspaper coverage, this is laughable. Harper's Weekly says, Vanderbilt has actually done a good thing. People are stunned. He's actually parted with his money for a noble cause, and he rather likes it. Now, you've got, on one hand, Frank's not done. She loves this man. She really does. Loves him enough to put up with the dislike of Vanderbilt's daughters, with the questioning of the rest of society. She's doing it for less money. In fact, Vanderbilt repeatedly regrets the prenuptial agreement that he signed. He says to her repeatedly, have I left you with enough money? And she says, that's okay. you know, we can laugh, 500,000, probably enough. And yet, clearly, it was there for the taking, and she won't take it. But she's got something in mind. Now, in that Southern sort of way, just about everybody's related in this story. In fact, I haven't told you just how much. Frank Vanderbilt is actually the first cousin twice removed of Cornelius Vanderbilt and his first wife. So he has, in effect, married a sizable part of his genetic code. If you do the math, in fact, it's pretty stunning how closely related they all are. She's just friends with deans, but she's got this other cousin who happens to be a bishop, who happens to ultimately be the person for, I think you have professorship. Mine is named for a governor of Indiana, which is a kind of, you know, semi-secular thing. You've got religion and academia there. Bishop McTeer, who happens to be Frank's cousin and her former pastor. He, along with a number of Southern Methodists, would love to see a new Methodist university in the South, and they have a dream of a central university, as it's called. Frank can do the math here. She knows how to, you know. She's got to get Cornelius Vanderbilt to invite Bishop McTeer up to New York. But he's got other things, and it's not happening. But she's got Deems now on the team. Deems gets into the act and says one evening to the Commodore after dinner, do you ever regret not being educated and going to school? And to his surprise, Vanderbilt doesn't say what typically he'd said in the past. He says, yes, I do. Actually, I do regret it very much. And he said, you know, when I went to Europe and I was with all of those dukes and barons, I was afraid to stand up and talk, which is true. When he went to Europe, Vanderbilt would have sons-in-laws get up and speak at ceremonial occasions because he felt that he was unlettered enough that he would have embarrassed himself, he thought. In the same way, he always had clerks write letters for him because he was embarrassed by his own spelling. And it's a really curious moment. I mean, Deems is a very smart man that Vanderbilt trusted, gets him to admit that underneath all of this, the richest man in the world feels rather insecure. And he says, I would give $1 million if I had an education, says Vanderbilt. And you're doing the math too. At that point, because nothing ever runs smooth, one of Vanderbilt's sons-in-law, a man named Horace Clark, comes in. Horace Clark had thought that he was better than Vanderbilt. A lot to think of yourself as a railway man. He ultimately dies virtually broke because of this. He had gone to Williams College. You know Williams College. Did anybody go to Williams here before I go down this route? Horace Clark is insufferably full of himself. He walks in on this conversation and says to Vanderbilt, I'm glad to see that you finally admit the truth that educated men are worthwhile and that even can be better than the uneducated. And the Commodore turns on him, needless to say, and Deems thinks, I was almost there. It's not to be. Then, once again, Victoria Woodhull and Tennessee Claflin turn up. Vanderbilt has no relationship with them anymore, not after that last episode, and it's not because of the money that he needed, that he had to spend to endow the Church of the Strangers. He was badly burned by them. They burn him again and worse because they've decided they can't get anything out of him anymore, so they turn on him. Tennessee Claflin, it's too great a story, but we'll spare you this. Her entire family is in court one day in Manhattan, which they often did. And she's on the stand being questioned on the subject of whether or not Colonel Blood had taken her away from her mother and denied her mother, Roxy, her proper due in the world, and in particular taken her out of the world of magnetic rubbing and spiritualism. And Tennessee says, I'm not going back to this, but I was really good at it. And she says, I can humbug, I can manipulate any man. I humbugged many rich people. I humbugged Cornelius Vanderbilt. And in a beautiful Victorian moment, and they knew double entendre better than we do, she said, he knows my power. Not a good moment, again, if you're Frank Vanderbilt reading the New York Herald and you read that one. And and you may be the richest man in the world, but the $95 million don't protect you from all of that. That's followed very soon after by Victoria Woodhull in a famous speech attacking Vanderbilt and comparing him at length to a thief and a robber, and saying that our society condemns small-time thieves and robbers and celebrates men like Vanderbilt. And she finishes off the speech by calling for inheritance taxes, which are the ultimate obscenity in the eyes of someone like Cornelius Vanderbilt, the notion that his money would be taken away. Not good. It gets worse. In the early 1870s, Woodhull and Claflin are arrested on obscenity charges. They use the pages of Woodhull and Claflin's weekly to leak the story of the alleged adultery of the most famous minister in America, Henry Ward Beecher, pastor of the Congregational Church, the Plymouth Church in Brooklyn. His adulterous affair, it's a famous thing, with his own parishioner. They're arrested for that, and it becomes a scandalous story. This goes on and on. In one of these episodes, Cornelius Vanderbilt himself has to go and testify in the trial against Woodhull and Claflin from one of their former investors in the brokerage. So there is this relentless pace of exposures in which Cornelius Vanderbilt is repeatedly reminded of what he had done with these women, and in which his wife continues to put up with it all in this very noble way. She had a great chin and she held it just in the right way to be noble. But she's still calculating. Finally, in 1872, she gets him to invite Bishop McTeer up here. And again, she's a very smart woman because, again, Vanderbilt refused to give money away, not simply because he thought that charity was problematic, but as I said, because he really believed that most of the people who were responsible for organized benevolence were incompetent. Charles Deans was anything but incompetent. He was an extraordinary preacher, he was an intellectual, he was a fine writer. And Vanderbilt was impressed by that. McTeer is impressive too, even more so. McTeer comes up to her. There's a great moment. Vanderbilt says to him, "You know, the greatest railroad lawyer in the world was destroyed when you became a minister." And he means it. He's one of the few people for whom calling someone a lawyer is a positive thing. A railroad lawyer is the ultimate accolade. McTeer is that. He's a brilliant man, brilliant organizer. He's not the preacher that Deans was. He was not personable and charismatic in the same way, but he was a brilliant organizer. And he did one thing in particular that Vanderbilt considered him the best at. He kept secrets really well. Vanderbilt's chief business bit of wisdom was not to tell anybody ever what you're going to do. Thus, you turn up in London, Ontario, marrying a 30-year-old, for example. He's deeply impressed with McTeer and begins to think, and see the point. McTeer brings up the Central University. So we've got Deans talking about it, McTeer talking about it. Frank, one of her cousins said, always had a delicate tact and an innovative spark. She knew the moment when she saw it. She has Vanderbilt take her out for their usual daily ride through Central Park. She has him go past the Astor Library. William Astor had founded this library. It's his only conspicuous act of charity. It's now part of the New York Public Library, Astor Lennox Tilden Foundation. She goes by the Astor Library and says, "You know, really, what a wonderful thing it is that the boys of the North have opportunities like this." And she extends a delicately gloved hand in the direction of this convenient backdrop, this pile of marble, that they have such opportunities and such universities. And the men of the South, and of course it's just a few years after the war, the men of the South don't have these things. They have so few, and even when there are institutions like that, they really can't afford them because of the war. Vanderbilt's note, I mean, he's seen this coming. And he says, "Well, what do you have in mind?" And Frank replies, "Well, a university." And again, I mean, McTeer's just like, and Vanderbilt's like, "Really?" "Can you detail that for me?" says this Napoleon of business. And she says, "Well, You know, I'm just a woman. You perhaps should talk to the bishop, who happens to be staying in our house in the upstairs bedroom with plans for this university. And, you know, and she conveniently doesn't say, gee, aren't we just a few blocks north of the bewitching broker's former brokerage? Vanderbilt goes home, has a serious talk. It's March of 1873. Has a serious talk with McTeer, and somewhat to McTeer's surprise, gives him $500,000 to found the Central University, which is going to be called Vanderbilt University. That was Deems's idea, who knew how to, you know, play a benefactor when he saw one. So it's that McTeer had no problem with that at all. The rest of the story is very well told. The things that went, Vanderbilt did everything with great care. I mean, as you can see, if he was going to give money, it could only be entrusted to someone really good. And in fact, for faculty in the audience, for those of us who are devotees of faculty governance, that kind of thing did not impress Commodore Vanderbilt. He didn't care too much for that. In fact, he didn't even like boards of trust. He had spent too much time with the boards of corporations. He trusted McTeer. He forced the writing up of this arrangement so that McTeer would have unusual power. It would be very clear that he had authority in this university. He wants it to be absolutely first class. In fact, he repeatedly gives more money until finally, before his death, he's brought the sum of his gifts, essentially $1 million. It's something like $995,000, but it's a substantial amount of money that he's invested in just the right person and just the right sort of cause. And as I say, the rest of the story is very familiar, but what fascinates me is the road that got him there. He didn't intend to give this money. Yet in some strange way, when his first wife died, he set off this train of circumstances by marrying Frank Vanderbilt, not knowing that she was going to make him give money for the Church of the Strangers or give money for Vanderbilt University, but knowing that she was different, that she cared about religion in ways that he did not, that she cared about good deeds in ways that he did not, that she cared about public benefaction as he didn't. Even then, he couldn't, though he clearly esteemed her a great deal, he couldn't know just how good her friends were, that Deems was as impressive as he was, that McTeer was as impressive as he was. She couldn't have known that she would have the really wonderful double good luck of always being seen against the backdrop of Woodhull and Claflin. He didn't know that he was going to be so relentlessly embarrassed by these two women. And embarrassed in ways that kept making him come back to the idea of charity, as among other things, clearly as a way of keeping peace in his marriage. So there's no sign whatsoever, you know, that Frank ever got upset with him and said, you know, I can put up with those women if you will do thus and such. They were both way too smart for that. They danced this wonderful gavotte from 1869 to 1873 that just happens to produce these benefactions, that just happens to produce this university. And it's fascinating to me because, as I say, Vanderbilt was widely understood to be a cruel man, a hard man. From my perspective, he was not dishonest. In fact, that's what people found difficult about him in the end, was they would have loved to hate him, and they couldn't do it. He couldn't do it because there was this basic kind of integrity about him. Even his business opponents conceded that. And they couldn't do it because of moments like the founding of Vanderbilt University. He didn't go and make himself a philanthropist. This is not like the end of A Christmas Carol, you know, where Scrooge loves it so much that he decides to become, you know, the kindest man, you know, the good old town had ever seen. No, Vanderbilt is not transformed by that. But he does enough, and does it in his thoroughgoing and sincere way, that people find it disarming. They want to hate him, but there's always, in discussions about him ever after, there's this kind of, but he did found Vanderbilt. What do we do with that? He didn't intend it that way either exactly. He was, though, obsessed with his name. And that's where you see one thing in particular. Vanderbilt liked his name and had a strange attachment to it. As I say, I don't fully understand the genetic side of it, but the way in which he marries people related by blood to him is quite striking. And again, this is in, remember, this is in a set of people who focus a great deal on the breeding of horses and dogs. You can laugh, but they thought a lot about, I mean, more so than most, about inbreeding and what you could do with it. He cared a lot about his name. He believed that the way his name would live was through his railroad, through the New York Central Railroad. Well, there is no New York Central Railroad anymore, is there? He thought it would last close to forever, and it didn't. He had a number of other monuments. He thought they would last, and they didn't. He thought that he'd ensured that the name Vanderbilt literally would survive forever. He would be shocked, you know, seven generations later, there are only three male Vanderbilt descendants of Cornelius Vanderbilt in that generation, for also interesting genetic reasons. So just about every way that the Commodore had planned on his name didn't survive, except here, where you have one of the great sports nicknames of the Commodores. That term, the Commodore, lives on here long since after it's been dissociated from that name. The final thing is that he didn't intend it. The way he wanted his name to survive, all of those ways didn't work. What he didn't really plan on, what he saw maybe as a way of propitiating his wife as a kind of act. But again, you know, this is a child of New York, and I have to say, as a New Yorker, you know, Vanderbilt, even though he built this far-flung railroad empire, clearly thought of Tennessee as being out there somewhere. There's a great letter I read this morning from William Henry Vanderbilt, his son, to Bishop of Tyre, which he says, "Thanks a lot for inviting me to Nashville. I am headed west, but you know, I'm going to be kind of busy." So it wasn't that. He really didn't expect it would matter in this way. And the final irony is, of course, that had to do with education. Vanderbilt was not an educated man. One of the ways that Deans got his goat once was saying, you know, "You are a terrible example to the young men of this country." And Vanderbilt says, "What do you mean?" He says, "Because they think, looking at you, that you don't need an education to succeed." And Vanderbilt just sit there and goes, "You know, you're right." And he did mean that. And in the end, this very uneducated man decides to make a commitment to education, and it paid off for the country, for this community. It paid off for him. And in the end, it was the value of education. I know the value of stopping. 45 minutes, I'm done. If you have questions, I'm glad to take them. Yes?
What became of Vanderbilt's money? To whom did he bequeath it?
Oh, that's another it's another talk. He was thoroughgoing. People widely believed, including Bishop McTeer, that Vanderbilt, when he died in 1877, was going to have left a will with more benefactions in it of one sort or another. He did not. People were surprised by that. They were still more stunned. As I said, he had eight daughters. He gave one of them $200,000. He gave another $300,000. He gave another $300,000. He gave the others $500,000 apiece. He gave his epileptic son, Cornelius Jeremiah Vanderbilt, $200,000 in trust. And he gave $500,000 for Frank as to their prenuptial agreement. All the rest went to William Henry Vanderbilt, which made him the richest man in the world on the spot. In effect, in essence, Cornelius Vanderbilt practiced primogeniture. It was shocking to people. So shocking for the family, they went to court, and in a really extraordinary trial that rivals the Beecher adultery trial, this thing lasts for 2 years as the Cornelius Jeremiah Vanderbilt and one of his sisters try to break the will. With witnesses disappear, witnesses make up testimony. There are witnesses who never existed. It's unbelievable what each side is conspiring to do to the other. William Henry Vanderbilt buys Victoria Woodhull a house in London, and she mistakenly gives him her letters to the Commodore and then asks for them back, and he gets what letters? So what the Commodore wanted was essentially, it's kind of crass, but he prunes the family tree in the most radical way. He decides he has one child who's worth something and who's got the name, who also had two sons of whom he thought highly. He gives them all the money. and he gives them the control of this railway empire, and he expects it to last for a good long time, which it does. The Vanderbilts are about the richest family in the world for two, probably three generations, until the Rockefellers really do supplant them. But it all comes undone. But no, Vanderbilt, how do you put it? Founding this university was an isolated act. It was not meaningless. I mean, truly, it was full of meaning for him. But he still saw his essential project as this business empire and weaving it together with the life, with the name of his family. So he makes William Henry a very rich man. William Henry, just to finish this off, who was very much put upon, this is the guy who was on the farm in Staten Island until 50. William is so deeply angry at his father that he goes out and more than doubles his inheritance inside of 10 years and then drops dead. At which point his sons think, okay, we had this Napoleonic figure for grandpa, would accuse us of not wanting to be him. Dad, on the other hand, was actually a nice guy, unlike the Commodore, and he was just as good as the Commodore. He drops dead trying to live up to all of this. What are we going to do? You go build the Breakers, Marble House, build more is what you do, and you dissipate it. That's the long answer. Yes?
One of our major undergraduate scholarships is the Harold Sterling Vanderbilt mm-hmm. Scholarship. Do you know how Harold got back involved with the university?
Sure. I work without visual aids. This is one of this is as close as I'm going to come as the invisible family tree here. Pathetic, isn't it? You're thinking best professor. Vanderbilt, the Commodore, has a son, William Henry Vanderbilt, who has, in the end, four sons, one of whom is William K. Willie K. Vanderbilt. William K. Vanderbilt builds, among other things, a Marble House with his wife, Alva Vanderbilt. They have three children, one of whom, Consuelo Vanderbilt, becomes the Duchess of Marlborough. If you know your English palaces, Blenheim Palace goes with the Duke of Marlborough and is the greatest palace in England outside of the royal families. They have another son, William K. Vanderbilt II, who founds the first real serious professional auto races in America. And they have Harold Sterling Vanderbilt, last, who's born in the 1880s. He's an interesting person. He was a very, very, very talented man, very bright. He worked in railroading, but he was famous for defending the America's Cup in yacht racing. He was an innovator in yachting. He invented, I love this, the Vanderbilt Start. You know, in yachting, they go, oh, the Vanderbilt Start. He's also known as, quote, the inventor of contract bridge. He was a famous player of bridge and codified, it's with all those things. Historians can beat any topic to death, so the origins of contract bridge like that. And you're thinking, well, we just heard the lecture, Michael. You know about that. There's dispute about this, but Harold Sterling Vanderbilt was, again, a brilliant man in what he chose to work at. Does that in contract bridge too. He loved his mother a lot. And late in life, as it's becoming clear to him that the Vanderbilts have not quite added up to what they might have added up to, he begins trying, I think in certain ways, reassembling the life of his mother and his family. For example, he buys Marble House, which she really had designed, if you've seen that house in Newport, it looks for her mansion. He buys that and donates it to the trust that owns these mansions in Newport, and he does it as a memorial to his mother, but explicitly. And he's an interesting character. He, like a number of Vanderbilt men, did not marry until quite late in life. And there were a number of stories about him. He had a long-standing relationship with a famous woman athlete in the 1910s and 20s, and then he married Gertrude Conaway, who was known for being the first woman ever allowed on an America's Cup yacht in action. She was esteemed so highly by the yachting fraternity. He had no children. One of the things it seems to me that he did as part of getting caught up in the life of his family was to become more involved in the university again, which is something his brother hadn't particularly done, and his father not so much. His father divorced his mother, interestingly. So, you know, I don't know this end of things as well as I know the earlier part, but to me it's part of his broader project of reconstructing the family and what it was and leaving a kind of memorial in various ways. Yes?
Two questions. Mm-hmm. First, what happened to Frank? And second, how was, the gift was made, Chief Vanderbilt to the town of Vanderbilt University, how was that characterized in the press at the time?
I had no idea that Vanderbilts were as interesting as they are when I started this. Really, no. I mean, I thought it was a good idea for a book, but it's stunning how many good characters there are. Frank Vanderbilt is one of them. She, when the Commodore died in 1877, she continued to do good works with the Church of the Strangers. She got on well with some. Well, she got on well with anybody who would get on well with her. But most of the Vanderbilts shunned her. William Henry Vanderbilt did not. That will trial was a brutal thing for her because Cornelius Jeremiah Vanderbilt and his sister alleged that William Henry had engaged in a conspiracy with her to take advantage of a supposedly senile Commodore and have him change the will, which is not true, so that it benefited only William Henry. And as part of this, they got a witness to swear, essentially, that she was having an affair with William Henry Vanderbilt. It produces an amazing scene in court because, and again, it's interesting about the double standard. For 2 years in this trial, the contestants of the will lied repeatedly about William Henry Vanderbilt. And people thought, well, that's what public life is like. That's what men put up with. It's a real turning point in the trial when Frank Vanderbilt is attacked in this way. And in fact, the contestants even use Bishop McTeer on the stand to use him inadvertently to leak the story of her divorce and to raise the possibility that she'd not in fact been divorced from her husband when she married the Commodore. So she becomes the focus of his, what again for Victorian sensibility is a quite shocking moment. When William Henry effectively wins the trial, he's appalled by what's been done to Frank Vanderbilt, and he forces the lawyers for Cornelius Jeremiah to apologize to her in court. And there's this really stunning ritual in which they apologize to her, and the judge at length berates them again for what they've done to this woman, and then praises them for at least trying to do this. It's a really remarkable moment, and again, it's an indirect acknowledgement of what an unusual person she was. You know, it's funny, the Commodore really, who planned for everything, and on his deathbed had said, you know, there's going to be hell to pay when I'm gone, had thought that there would be a trial, I think, but he clearly had no idea that Frank was going to be trashed in all of this. And in fact, I think it's the one thing that probably would have forced him to rethink what he'd done. She had fairly poor health. The stuff about her complaining about the steps, I realized belatedly going up to this church at NYU, she had heart trouble of some kind. She died in 1885, basically living a very quiet life that again persuaded people that she hadn't married the Commodore as some sort of fortune hunter. She was what she was. She's really an enigma to people beyond this clear religiosity. As I say, you could get up and argue that this university would not have happened if she had not willed it to be so. She did. In fact, it's remarkable how she keeps pushing away. There's hilarious stuff in the special collections over here about the Commodore's long last illness, where she's writing with tears saying, look, I know you want those medals to give out on Founders Day, and I'm working on it, but, you know, and she says, he sleeps a lot. So I don't think it would have happened if I missed her. You asked me second
question. The second question was, how was his gift to create the university characterized in the press?
Oh, yeah. Actually, my favorite reaction, given where I went to school, was an editorial in the Hartford Courant, which says, well, you know, that was a good thing for the Commodore to do, and we suppose it's a good thing that there's education in the South, but, you know, there are established universities, great universities in this country, that could use support, too. There are a number of religious papers, no, not so much religious papers, some religious papers and a number of ordinary newspapers that say, you know, if churches are going to bow down at the altar of mammon in this way, blah, 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 we should give up on churches, we should give up on universities. Overall, interesting, it's the religious press and ministers who, in part because of their own theologies, took Vanderbilt at his word, and were not, in fact, it's not just that they were getting the money. They believed that, you know, men could repent of what they had done. But there are a number of secular onlookers who thought this was absurd. For Southern newspapers, this was a heck of a moment. Again, just 8 years after the end of the Civil War, you've got a Yankee whose only other notable public benefaction, he had given a steamship named, of course, the Cornelius Vanderbilt. You can see the young Donald Trump leading the life of Cornelius Vanderbilt. He gives a steamship called the Cornelius Vanderbilt to the Union government. So here's this Yankee who was a big, bold supporter of the Union cause, reaching out to the South. So there's a lot of hands across the bloody chasm rhetoric of the kind they specialized in. But again, it was generally seen as a good thing. And people were really mystified by why it was happening. Yes?
There is a certain parallel, to my understanding, between this story and the foundation of Rockefeller University, the Rockefeller family, where also a minister played a role in influencing a very, well, disciplined, hard man.
Yeah.
Did Rockefeller know about
that? Oh, sure.
I mean,
there, the Vanderbilts and Rockefeller did business together over shipping his oil and over access to coal. There are two interesting points of comparison right off. One of them is that John D. Rockefeller Jr., you may know this, had a nervous breakdown, as it was characterized then, at the age of 17, essentially over the pressure of following his father. And his father concluded that it was too hard to expect his son to inherit money in the way in which William Henry Vanderbilt had inherited it. And given his own inclinations, he was a deeply religious man and were given to philanthropy. It's the illness of his son that really completes for him the sense that the best thing he can do is to try to create a separate path for his children that involves philanthropy and that doesn't involve this Darwinian kind of struggle that's been killing people left and right like the Vanderbilts. The second difference is that Cornelius Vanderbilt really, as I say, didn't care very much about philanthropy, but he was disturbed by the fact that there were so many people who wanted his money, and that so few of them were, from his perspective, any good. And he had other things to focus on. Vanderbilt really worked up until he died. Really remarkable. So he was fully engaged in business in a way that John D. Rockefeller was not in very old age. But he doesn't then, so Cornelius Vanderbilt doesn't take the time to do what John D. Rockefeller does, which is to say, okay, if I care about philanthropy, what I should do is be systematic. What I should do is get professionals to handle all of this for me. And it's his principal, Rockefeller's principal advisor in this, and given the time, I'm forgetting the name.
Gates,
thank you. Is a man of the cloth, as they would have said. So Rockefeller is a different, somewhat different sensibility, but the Vanderbilts come first and are such a cautionary tale in some ways for other wealthy people that they're encouraged to find a different path. Yes?
You comment on the story that Commodore considered putting the university in Mobile because of all the Mobile connections, but decided against it. Fever, and they really didn't have a good railroad.
Well, you're answering your question. You're answering the question.
I think that's a true story.
Oh, yeah. There are other people who know the mechanics, the precise mechanics of the founding better than I do. But what you said is basically right. Mobile was one possibility. It's not what McTeer wanted. McTeer had been a minister in Mobile. and had connections there, but the whole focus of this plan for a central university was up here. And Vanderbilt himself had no particular, didn't care one way or another. He wanted to do what McTeer thought would make sense. He really respected him. So it was simpler to go along with the Nashville thing. And Frank wanted it there too. She wasn't going to go against what McTeer wanted either. And Nashville was such a center for the Methodist movement in the South that it was natural for everybody. But you're quite right, there were concerns about health. The railroading thing was even up all the way. I mean, the Vanderbilts would have built a railroad to it if they had to, and that was a natural thing for them. In fact, it was a pain. The fact that the Vanderbilts had been involved in founding this university continually produced rumors about the family trying to get involved with the Louisville and Nashville Railroad, and William Henry would always be saying, yes, we've got the university there, but I have no interest in the Louisville and Nashville. So it was really separate from their calculations about railroads and all of that. Yes?
Did you come by your interest pursuit of the Vanderbilts?
I have friends who say that I really just want to be rich myself. I'm drawn to it as a moth to the flame. I guess there are a couple of things that do fascinate me about the rich. First of all, as you said, I'm basically a political historian, and I've written two books that argue that in many ways the United States in the 20th century is less democratic than it was in the 19th century. But I also believed, and came to believe in the course of writing this last book I did about progressives, that I was struck that the rich did not get nearly all of what they wanted to get out of the late 19th century, that these pioneering industrial robber baron types like the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, and the Vanderbilts, especially the Vanderbilts and the Astors, wanted to create a self-perpetuating hereditary nobility in America. I really believe that. And that did not happen. And I've wanted to study that, and the Vanderbilts were a good way to do it because they were so obvious about it. One talk I give, for example, is about the fashion among Vanderbilt women of wearing crowns in public, and I mean real crowns, in the late 19th century, and what was behind that, and the real aspirations that were behind that are marrying a daughter to the Duke of Marlborough. So for me, the unmaking of this family and of its plans, which were reflected a broader sensibility among the rich, that they could create a nobility in America, that's part of what I wanted to do. I also am interested in the notion of wealth as a problem. I mean, it sounds kind of silly, but that it's difficult to have, and its burden. There's an obituary of William Henry Vanderbilt, which it says he was crushed underneath the weight of wealth. And there is something to that, and what fascinates me was how hard it was for the rich to find a way of life that would both pacify the American public and be a sensible way to bring up their own children. And I wanted to explore that in the most intimate way I could, and there was this family here. The last thing is nobody, on one hand, there are all sorts of Americans who've been to Vanderbilt houses, but there are very few academics who have taken the Vanderbilt seriously for generations, so there's a kind of wide open space to write about them. So, well, we'll see. Yes.
One more question.
Okay. Sure. Yes, sir.
I've always wondered where the title the Commodore came from.
Oh, sure. Like a lot of things, it started as a joke and a put-down. Cornelius Vanderbilt was a very striking man. He was over 6 feet tall. As I say, people would often say he looked like a bishop. He was a very driven, serious type. He basically went into business at 15 with this little boat, a Perry auger. And he was competing in a serious way by his late teens with other boatmen and shippers in New York Harbor. And really, as a joke and a put-down, they would call him the Commodore when he was a teenager. And like many nicknames, what started as a joke became a serious honorific, and one that Vanderbilt himself started to use. Frank Vanderbilt, for example, calls her husband the Commodore, or in her letters, the Com. See all the time, but it's that, and he kept you know, people used it to talk about him when he got this railroad empire, but basically by the time he was middle-aged, by the time he's in his 40s, he's called the Commodore as a tribute in the way some people would be called a colonel or something, but it was meant, as I say, what had been a joke 25 years before was dead serious. Later in life, most of all, they called him the king. You know, in fact, their editorials when he dies, they call him the dead king. They don't call him the dead Commodore. The Commodore is resurrected as a way of differentiating him from other kings. But that's where it comes from. Thank you very much.